905 and 2005 UTC right after the internet.
Is the world winning the battle against HIV/AIDS? With fewer AIDS deaths and fewer HIV infections around the globe, has it become a forgotten pandemic? Also, we'll take a close look at South Africa, which is at the epicenter of the AIDS crisis, and how politics in public health has helped and hurt progress in that country. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Hello there and welcome. I'm Heidi Adams. Thank you so much for joining me. More than 38 million people worldwide are living with HIV. The World Health Organization says fewer people are dying of AIDS and fewer people are being infected with HIV compared to, say, 10 years ago. More people have access to HIV prevention, diagnosis, treatment, and care. But there is still no cure. And today we ask, are we winning the fight against HIV/AIDS? But first, I want to turn your attention to South Africa. That nation runs the largest HIV treatment program in the world. But their history with AIDS has been particularly controversial. Scientists say for years, HIV/AIDS has slashed life expectancy and wiped out a generation of economically active adults in their prime across sub-Saharan Africa. They blame a deadly mixture of AIDS denialism and policies that refused millions of South Africans life-saving drugs. Here's a look at how South Africa reached a turning point in its fight against AIDS.
We are launching a massive campaign to mobilize all South Africans to get tested for HIV. Every South African should know his or her HIV status.
In April 2010, then South African President Jacob Zuma said the words scientists, activists, and those living with HIV/AIDS in the country had been waiting to hear for years.
All pregnant HIV positive women with CD4 count of 350 or with symptoms, regardless of the CD4 count, will have access to treatment.
It was a dramatic turnaround for South Africa, which was at the epicenter of the deadly AIDS pandemic. At the time, the country had the highest number of people living with HIV in the world. Zuma's predecessor, Thabo Mbeki, made international headlines in 2000 when he began casting doubt over whether HIV causes AIDS.
You see, when you ask the question, does HIV cause AIDS? The question is, does a virus cause a syndrome? How does a virus cause a syndrome? It can't.
For nearly a decade, President Mbeki questioned AIDS statistics, the efficacy of antiretroviral drugs, saying they were toxic, and suggested poverty and poor nutrition caused AIDS. In the face of about 1,000 AIDS-related deaths a day in South Africa, then Health Minister Mantu Shabalala Msimang promoted a concoction of alcoholic drinks, fruits and vegetables to treat HIV. Mbeki restricted the use of drug therapies like nevirapine and withdrew government support for clinics administering AZT to prevent mother-to-child transmission of HIV. South Africa's AIDS drugs dispute triggered international condemnation, nationwide protests, and overshadowed the country's first national AIDS conference in Durban in 2003.
People were dying of HIV and no one was taking responsibility and we were told to eat garlic and all those things.
Sibongile Chabalala is an activist with South Africa's Treatment Action Campaign. She contracted HIV more than 20 years ago. She says South Africa has come a long way since those difficult years. Today, people like her are able to live with HIV/AIDS instead of dying from it.
I was diagnosed with HIV in 2000 and started ARVs in 2006. And in 2008, I had my second born. My third born was born in 2011, of which both of my children are HIV negative. Some of us wouldn't be here if it wasn't for ARVs.
Critics say Mbeki's handling of the AIDS crisis caused more than 300,000 preventable deaths. For Shabalala, South Africa's experience underscored the dangers of science denialism and politicizing public health.
What is important is to save people's lives before pushing our own ideology. When COVID came, it was affecting everyone, but we've seen countries like South Africa and India challenging other countries to say, we need to save people's lives. That's a kind of politics that we want to see, where when we engage early on the issues of health, then we are able to save more lives.
So what lessons can we learn from South Africa's fight against HIV and AIDS? And has that experience helped the country's ability to respond to other infectious diseases? Well, when it comes to global health experts, it doesn't get any better than my guest today. Salim Abdul Karim is an infectious disease epidemiologist, a professor of global health at Columbia University, and the director of the Center for AIDS Program of Research in South Africa. He joins us from Durban, South Africa. And joining us from Smyrna in the U.S. state of Delaware is Talbot Nyenswa. He's a senior research associate at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Talbot specializes in public health emergencies, preparedness and response. Gentlemen, what a great pleasure to have you here. And before we kick things off, I am fully aware of how learned you are, so I hope you don't mind if I refer to you by your first names. I just don't want to get all the professors out of sync here. Salim, I'm going to start with you with the South African experience. Of course, the irony here in the story is that it is the very same president who, during his 2006 rape trial, said that he admitted he had unprotected sex with an HIV-positive woman and then took a shower instead of wearing a condom to prevent HIV infection. That same president is being credited today for rolling out probably South Africa's largest and most ambitious, or at least kickstarting it, ambitious HIV treatment program. What lessons can we learn from South Africa's initial handling of the HIV/AIDS crisis and then from that country's political and policy turnaround?
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here. I mean, put very simply, South Africa started its response to the AIDS pandemic disastrously. When you have a politician who questions science and challenges a very fundamental aspect of this disease and then refuses to accept that treatment has benefits for its population, you are in a situation where you can only get worse. And the estimations are that over 300,000 people lost their lives prematurely as a result of not getting access to treatment. We're very fortunate in the sense that even though we had a denialist president that withheld treatment, with elections and with all of the political processes, we have a new president coming in and he sweeps clean. Even though his own track record may not be the best, on the issue of HIV, he made critically important decisions and decisions that put South Africa on track to really deal with this pandemic. And we dealt with it decisively, making treatment available, moving towards elimination of mother-to-child transmission, a whole lot of initiatives on prevention, but ultimately ensuring that people got access to treatment.
Talbot, South Africa is but one example, but how problematic is that, though, when political leaders who essentially control the public purse strings, who have such influence, can go in public and question science, question the statistics, and actually make life and death policy decisions? Talbot?
Yes. Actually, there is no substitute for political leadership. You cannot substitute for political leadership in an outbreak response. It is the politicians and the government leadership that can mobilize the community. And so if you start to see or hear deniability, denialism, complacency, and refusal to accept an output as it is, then you put people at arms with. And that was the case with the South African situation. But there is no gloom and doom about that. I think they have learned significant lessons now and put people to work, as my colleague was saying, and mobilize the community to get ARVs to people, lifelong ARVs, saving, life-saving drugs to people to use them. And those lessons are resonating now with South Africa. You saw how COVID-19 came in and the government was able to move in quickly to put some of the measures in place.
Salim, just as Talbot mentioned now, COVID-19, that pandemic is probably the most recent example where we saw on social media, on television, for everyone to see how governments essentially dealt with this. But what have you found in the case of the COVID pandemic response about how politicians can help or hurt a country's readiness and ability to respond and cope with a public health emergency?
I think we've seen how politics and particularly leaders who are supposed to set the stage and set the example can have quite a substantial impact on the behavior within the public. So when you have a situation where the president is in denial, you have a situation where many of the politicians follow that, even though it's directly against what the science is showing. We're very fortunate in the situation when we were faced with COVID-19, where a president that took a very different perspective, in that he chose to act quickly, he chose to act decisively, he chose to bring the country's scientists together to give scientific advice. So we had, you know, in many ways, the polar opposites. And as a result, in COVID-19, what we had in our first wave, what we saw was a flattening of the curve. We saw the way in which the interventions had an impact, whereas in HIV, we saw how the lack of interventions was leading to death.
Talbot, from your experience with HIV, with Ebola, malaria, COVID, what is your assessment of how other African countries have been responding to the public health crisis we've seen in recent years? Are you seeing in the main a marked improvement in some places? And are there some countries that really stand out in terms of how to do things right?
I think the continental approach that came to bear during the COVID-19 response, when the first cases of COVID were reported and diagnosed in North Africa, in Egypt, the fact that we had the African Center for Disease Control, the Africa CDC, that did not exist before Ebola struck in West Africa, when I was the incident manager of the Ebola response in Liberia. We saw the delay in response. We saw the fragility in the healthcare system. The international response and the local response combined brought the number of deaths that we saw in the three most affected countries, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, with 28,000 cases and over 11,000 deaths. But now we saw a tale of two outbreaks. When COVID-19 struck, because Africa CDC were established immediately after the Ebola crisis, the governments of Africa mobilized under WHO Regional Office for Africa, the Africa CDC, and put in place system for testing, put in place system for contact tracing, port of entry. For example, in Ethiopia, you saw that there was marked mandate where 100% of the population, it may not be 100%, but close to that was wearing masks. And countries started testing, quickly tracing the contacts, border entries improved, border security improved. And so this we saw because of the experience with Ebola, experience with measles, Lassa fever, meningitis, and all of these other infectious diseases that Africa is dealing with. In as much as the health system challenges coupled with the increase in non-communicable diseases like cancer, we saw Africa did a great job with COVID as compared to other regions of the world.
Well, gentlemen, we're going to take a short break here. After the break, we're going to look at whether we are winning the fight against AIDS. So do stay with us. We'll continue this discussion on the other side of the break. We'll be back in a moment.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Winning the fight against HIV/AIDS, and what happens when public health becomes a political issue? Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa. And joining me are global health experts Salim Abdul Karim in South Africa and Tolbert Nyenswa here in the state of Delaware in the United States. Salim, I want to throw it back to you, that very question that I asked earlier. Are we winning the fight against HIV/AIDS, or as a global community, should we brace ourselves for a consolation prize at least?
Well, there isn't a simple answer to that question, because winning is a complicated concept. I think when you look at the number of new infections and you look at the number of deaths due to HIV, we have made incredible progress in the last 15 years. What we have seen is that the last 3 years during the COVID pandemic, we've seen some of that progress being eroded, and we've gone back in some instances. So it's a question of we've made good progress, we've had a setback, but we're getting back on track. And when you look at our overall goal in Africa, that we, because 70% of the global burden of HIV is in our continent, we carry a huge responsibility in terms of the overall pandemic. If we can't reduce the number of new infections and deaths in Africa, it's not going to bode well for our progress at a global level. And what does that mean for us in Africa? It means that we're going to have to redouble our efforts. Given that COVID-19 has sucked up all the air and all of the attention, it has put HIV in a situation where it was given a bit of a backseat. But I'm very pleased that, you know, now that it's coming back to the fore, we're putting back the energy, the effort, and we're getting back on track. And I think that's a better way to describe it rather than simply referring to it as win or lose.
I think in many things in life, we can say winning is a complicated subject. Absolutely. Tolbert, has this become a sort of forgotten pandemic of sorts precisely because we have been making so much progress? And by we, I don't mean to include myself. I am not really doing anything. However, as a global community, as a science community, we're seeing fewer deaths and infections. We're seeing more scientific advances. Is that part of the reason why we think everything is okay and on track?
Well, I agree with my colleague Salam. There is no one answer to the question of whether or not we are human. What we can surely say is that progress has been made. But the last 2 years, it has been you know, with multiple and overlaying crises. We dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic, humanitarian crisis, we're dealing with wars, we're dealing with food insecurity, the economic disparities that are happening across the world, has really put Africa in a difficult position, because remind you, we are in an interconnected world where, you know, agencies that the Global Fund, the U.S. President for Emergency Aid Relief, PEPFAR, these countries are dealing with their own response and huge healthcare burden that COVID-19 and other crises have put to bear. This has a huge implication on how Africa is dealing with HIV and AIDS, and not HIV and AIDS, but other opportunistic infections and other tissues like malaria, dealing with infectious diseases, and the rise of non-communicable diseases, actually. And so we are now in a difficult position, but hopefully with the multi-sectoral collaboration and partnership coming around HIV AIDS and all of these issues, and even I always stress the need that African leaders need to make their own health issues a priority. And you see the way South Africa came with the whole HIV and AIDS response, the great job from President Ramaphosa on, you know, 80% of people receiving care for HIV and AIDS coming from the government. We need to put resources from the government, community partnership, community engagement into HIV and AIDS. That's how we win the war.
Salim, but we still don't have a cure for AIDS. Can we expect to see eradication even if there is no cure, but simply because you stop transmission?
So the world came together in 2016 at the United Nations in New York, and all of the countries pledged under the new UN high-level meeting declaration. And the goal that was set is to end AIDS as a public health threat by 2030. And it acknowledged that we cannot eradicate HIV. We can't. We've got something like 38 million people living with HIV, and we have no cure. And it acknowledged we can't eliminate this virus because the virus itself, it goes and sits in individual people deep within their tissues in reservoirs that you can't get at. The antiretroviral drugs can't reach there. So we acknowledge we can't eradicate, we can't eliminate, but what we can do is we can get to a situation where HIV is no longer this threatening disease where large numbers of people are dying, but rather one that we have under some measure of control and where the number of new cases are also steadily diminishing. And that's the goal that the global community has set. And as it stands, we are making good headway on that in many countries, but unfortunately, in several others, we are actually, in some instances, even going backwards.
Speaking about the UN and going backwards, the UN's theme for World AIDS Day is equalize, and this is around their disparities in the fight against HIV/AIDS. Talbot, what are the disparities being talked about here, and why do we still see these kinds of challenges about inequality and a lack of access, especially in the fight against AIDS, which has been with us for so long?
Where we can say, yes, we eliminate the disease, everyone has to be on board. The underserved population, the special targeted population that we are not reaching, these people need the care most than even we talk about wealthy people, poor countries, because trust me, we can eliminate the disease by 2030 in high-income countries, and still have in low middle income countries in Africa that bear the highest burden right now, no one is out of the hook with HIV and AIDS. And this is where the inequality comes in. COVID-19 again has pronounced the issue of inequalities with disease outbreak controls, giving resources, drugs, vaccines, and therapeutics. We saw rich countries hoarding these commodities to themselves and leaving out low and middle income countries and poor populations. So in HIV and AIDS, we have to equalize, we have to give support to people that need them, because the higher burdens is within that population that we are leaving behind. So no one should be left behind with prevention, treatment, services, care, and support.
You got me a little hopeful there for a minute, Talbot. Salim, I want to turn to money. You know, in the world of international development, there's always this talk about donor fatigue when it comes to some of the world's biggest problems. Your work centers on AIDS research. Are we seeing funding fatigue in certain corners when it comes to putting money behind HIV/AIDS research, treatment, and prevention?
So HIV, because of the very nature of it, has been in a position where it has been able to attract funding, and that has largely been through two main organizations, and that's the Global Fund Against Malaria, TB, and HIV, and the President's Emergency Fund for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR, in the US. So these two mechanisms are critically important. Unfortunately, the Global Fund has not been able to achieve its target that it had set for the replenishment. So it had set a target of, I think it was $17 billion, if I'm not mistaken, as what it needed to raise to ensure that the global response was kept on track. It has got close to it, and that's pleasing to note, but some countries, you know, just didn't fulfill their initial commitments, for example, the UK. Now, given there's a shortfall at the Global Fund, that is going to have repercussions in many countries in that they won't get their full funding in order to implement their prevention and treatment program. So there will be some impact that there will be as a result of us not being able to meet our global targets. But on the other hand, fortunately, that impact will be somewhat mitigated by the fact that the shortfall is modest, and in many countries, we hope that local funding may help to cover that.
Talbot, briefly, what is your take, especially when it comes to funding for African countries, those that need it most?
The developed world have to support those countries that need resources. Again, our health is tied to the health of people in developing countries. The US, the UK, high-income countries cannot disassociate themselves from low-income countries left in Africa. So resources have to be put in there and keep the bricks, keep our feet on the pillars, and move on with an end to the HIV pandemic. And it is doable, but it has to be collected effort, and not rich and poor, but in one unison.
Salim, we saw pretty harsh lockdowns in some countries. China today is probably the most extreme case. But in African countries, looking back now, where there were tough lockdowns in places like South Africa, in countries like Uganda, were those absolutely necessary, looking back at it now? And were those particular measures effective and successful?
I think, hindsight is always 60-60. So you have to look at the situation that was faced in Africa at the time. Little was known about the virus. The images that we were seeing of patients dying in droves in Italy, in New York City, hospitals being overwhelmed. The picture was one of, in Africa, how much worse is it going to be? And so we needed to take action. We need to take action even in the midst of uncertainty. But that action is really to save lives. And I think that those decisions that were taken to initially instigate these harsher lockdowns were part and parcel of the process that we had to undertake at that time. Now that we have a better understanding of this virus, and now that we have vaccines, and now that we have treatments available, we don't need to use such harsher measures. We have the ability to control this virus with a range of our biological tools like vaccines and our public health measures. So the shifting terrain of our knowledge and the way in which the virus is spreading requires us to respond in different ways at different times.
Well, gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it there, but I do thank you for your time, Abdul Karim Salim and Talbot Nyenswa. Thank you for sharing your insights and your knowledge with us. That is it for our show. Thank you to our affiliate stations for airing Straight Talk Africa across the continent. And thank you for joining us on television, radio, and for streaming with us online. We will see you next time. Until then, it's goodbye.